Each of us is born with an innate sense of wonder and an instinctive yearning to learn more about the world we live in. Yet how many of us retain that same unbridled inquisitiveness into adulthood? Welcome to the Eudaimonia podcast. I'm Kim Forrester, and today we're going to explore the incredible concept called curiosity.
Welcome to Eudaimonia, the podcast that is all about flourishing. Plug in, relax, and get ready for the goodness as we explore the traits and practices that can help you thrive in life. With your host, Kim Forrester.
Dr. Diane Hamilton is an award-winning speaker and nationally syndicated radio show host based in Arizona, USA. She writes and speaks on business, leadership, emotional intelligence and curiosity, career and education, and she is the author of several popular books, including her latest title, Cracking the Curiosity Code. It's my pleasure to be connecting with Diane today to explore the concept of curiosity and to learn why it's easier to achieve our goals when we actively seek out our discomfort zone. Diane Hamilton, it is such a delight to have you with me here on the Eudaimonia podcast. How are things with you today in Arizona?
Everything's great. We're having beautiful weather. Thank you for having me, Kim. I was really looking forward to this.
Let's start with your book, fascinating book. In it, you explained that curiosity is present in non-human animals as well. I love this. And you say that scientists have apparently found what they call a curiosity gene. Can you perhaps explain more about this genetic disposition for curiosity and how it affects our brains and our bodies?
Well, you know, we all are born super curious. And like you said, animals have it. The Max Planck Institute coined the term the curiosity gene, because without curiosity, we wouldn't exist. Think about a bird. If it's flying around a bush and it runs out of berries, if it wasn't curious enough to go look at the next bush, then it's not going to live very long. So we're all that way. We need to explore. We need to get out of just that everyday status quo thinking, or you cease to thrive. So something I found really fascinating, because children are super, super curious when they're young. And then around age five, it starts to peak and it starts to decline. And same thing happens with creativity and a lot of things within us. And I was very curious as to why that happened. So that's what led to my interest in studying curiosity.
That's fascinating that we start losing it at around the age of five, because that's precisely when in our modern society we're sent off to school to learn. So just as we're sort of sent off to sort of gain the knowledge that we're supposed to gain, we start losing the curiosity. Do you feel that there's a link there somewhere?
In my research, I found some of the things that are inhibiting to us. And one of them is environment. And, you know, as you get into school, it's impossible for teachers to answer every single question. You know, when you're at home, parents could do the why thing all day long. But when you've got 35 students, or how many students are, you know, there's a lot of that impact. And even as you age, I don't know if you've seen Sir Ken Robinson's famous TED talk, but he talks about how schools kill creativity. And he talks about it even in the higher education arena, that you start to want to have graduate degrees and it's all science and math based. And some of this stuff that we want to go back to, we've kind of educated ourselves out of it due to the times of what we needed to have people do in terms of their skills. You know, if we needed people doing manufacturing or whatever it was we needed. And but so now we need people to be more creative and curious. So I think we're going to see much more of a directed attempt to improve curiosity. I know I work with some major organizations that are really focused on that.
Now, I know that our brains literally reward us for curiosity. That's how important it is to our existence, our evolution, correct?
Right.
This kind of indicates then that there's a powerful biological reason for curiosity to exist. What do you feel that we gain from being curious creatures, other than being able to attain, you know, tertiary qualifications and become experts in certain topics? What do we gain from being curious?
Well, you know, I know there's so many things that we need to gain that I look at in organizations. And as I started to write the book, I started to understand that curiosity ties into so many of the things that we hope to achieve. So let's say you're baking a cake, okay? And let's say you have flour and eggs and oil and whatever it is you need to mix to the ingredients, right, to make this cake. You put it together, you put it in the pan, you put it in the oven, what happens? Well, if you didn't turn on the oven, nothing happens, right? You get goo. Okay, and so with the workplace, if their cake that they're trying to bake is this productivity, is their cake, but they're taking the ingredients of motivation and creativity and innovation and engagement and all the things they're trying to accomplish, they're mixing all these things together and they're getting goo because nobody's turned on the oven, which is curiosity. And so when you say, what does it help with? Well, that's what it helps with, all those things. Everything you could think of that people are struggling with in the workplace right now, innovation, engagement, productivity, just everything. Because if you get into status quo thinking, you're just doing the same thing over and over again.
So I guess the trick is, and this occurs in life as well, obviously not just in the workplace, but at some point, it's about consciously stopping and asking why, right? Why am I doing this? What is the purpose behind this? Is that something that you would kind of encourage people to do more often?
Right. And it's not just why, it's why not? You know, why are we doing it this way? Why aren't we doing it this way? You know, it's all the questions of exploration. And, you know, a lot of companies, there's a lot of good examples of companies who realize the value of this. I give one in the book of a hospital in England where they were having problems with people dying as they were transporting from one location to the next after surgery. And they just could not make it any better. They went through all the things they thought they could do. And then one night, the leaders were watching a Formula One race car event, saw them. The Ferrari team took apart the car, put it back together, 7 seconds, perfect. And they're thinking, well, how can they do that? And we can't do this. So they actually invited the team back to the hospital to watch what they did. And they gave three simple suggestions of, you know, things to communicate better and different things. And they really made a marked improvement on their transfer procedures. So it's because we think we have to stay within our cubicle or within our silo or within our organization, within our industry, that we're not thinking that you really need to look everywhere.
So let's go there, because you actually say that one of the most important things we should understand about curiosity is the list of things that prevent us from being curious. And we're kind of touching on that now. So you list four curiosity roadblocks in your book. And for me, three of these roadblocks, we've got fear, assumptions, and social pressures. They seem pretty straightforward to me. I think we can sort of work our way through those. But you list the fourth restricting factor as technology, and that really surprised me, Diane. How can technology prevent us from fully engaging our curiosity?
Well, you know, you bring up the four factors, and it's the acronym of FATE to remember more easily, and they're fear, assumptions, technology, and environment. And as you mentioned, fear, you know, is pretty straightforward. Assumptions is really that voice in your head, that what you tell yourself. And then environment, we've touched on a lot with education, but there's so much more. It's everybody you've actually had contact with in your life, basically. But technology was a surprise to me as well. But technology, we either over or underutilize it sometimes. And if you don't have the foundation behind why a calculator works, you may have been the greatest mathematician of all times, but you rely on your calculator, right? You know, but you've never really learned what's behind it. So I think a lot of what we see in the workplace is a lot of people over relying on technology and not understanding the basics behind it, because the basics build that real logic sense of, you know, why things happen this way and how did anybody's learned programming, you learn logic and you learn so many different things. I don't think we all need to be programmers, but I think it would really help to know a lot more about why things work the way they do. And I think we could have low tech days where we don't rely on it too much, you know, and learn some of that basics. I mean, in some generations, they're terrified of it. So they stay away from it. And they could be learning so many more things and applying technology to so many more things. So, you know, that's the underutilization of it. We may be just terrified and think, oh, I can't figure this out. It's just too much, is overwhelming. And then we get in, you know, kind of a crossover to the assumptions in our head. of the things we tell ourselves that, you know, it's just too much. Last time I learned it, then they just got a new version of it, and then I had to learn it again, you know, and then you get wrapped up in those assumptions. So some of these things overlap to some extent, which can lead to fear, of course. And then, no, I don't want to do that. It's too hard. I can't, you know. And so what was interesting to me was coming up with the questions that are so critical to ask to uncover some of these things that are holding us back. Because once we can get this down in front of us in this report, the Curiosity Code Index I created, it gives you, you know, here's the things that are holding you back. And so now you can create an action plan. It helps you to do that. And create these smart, measurable goals of plans to just, you know, baby step your way to becoming more curious.
So it's actually a capacity that you feel we can strengthen, we can train and enhance.
Yeah. And I definitely think that you're going to see a lot more companies focusing on this. I've been working with Novartis and Verizon and big names that they're the leaders are just saying this is what we want for our core culture. We know to be innovative, we have to get over this, you know, wanting to control everybody's thoughts and let them explore and ask questions. And, you know, we have to model this behavior as leaders and say, you know, we're vulnerable. We can ask questions we don't know the answers to. And we can say, you know, this is what we want to see in you. Because unless leaders model what they want their culture to be, it's not going to happen.
So can curiosity help us develop other useful traits, perhaps creativity, perhaps innovation? Are there other traits as well that curiosity will help us enhance?
Well, it definitely leads to those types of traits. I've had experts on my show who are creativity experts, or, you know, I've had so many amazing people from Harvard and other universities talk about this. And every time I ask them what comes first when they talk about motivation or drive or innovation or creativity, they all say curiosity. So it definitely would be the step one before you go up to these other steps. And it was interesting to me because my next book's on perception. And when I was looking at perception, curiosity tied in a lot to that, because to truly understand people from your perception of how they see you and you, how you see them and the whole way people intercommunicate, you have to be curious and ask questions. As you ask questions, you develop empathy, which is a huge part of emotional intelligence. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on emotional intelligence, and empathy is so critical for communication because you are able to understand what other people need from their perspective. So that all tied in to perception, which was interesting to me because perception basically included not just like IQ and EQ, but, you know, and cultural quotients as well, CQ, and then curiosity quotient, CQ too, or whatever you want to give it for a Q. But I think that curiosity ties into so much more that you're going to be hearing much more about.
Let's turn the question on its head then. So you were saying that the experts kind of say curiosity comes first, but Diane, are there other traits or characteristics that we ought to strengthen in order to become more curious? It seems to me that some people might not be curious or at least engage the curiosity because they're afraid of being wrong or they're afraid of stepping into their discomfort zone. So if we become braver or more resilient, do you think that that would actually help us become more curious?
Well, yes, definitely. That's the F in fate, what holds us back, the fear. And fear is definitely the thing I thought I'd hear the most of when I started researching this, because nobody wants to look stupid. Nobody wants to ask that question in a meeting that makes you look like you're unprepared or dumb or whatever it is that people are worried about, right? So yes, you know, you have to work on these issues of fear in terms of what holds you back, because that will definitely help you become more curious. Once you realize that no question is really a dumb question, the problem is a lot of leaders have set up this sense from what they've heard works in the past as leaders, and some of it doesn't work. For example, don't come to me with problems unless you have solutions. Well, if you say that as a leader, it sounds really good because you think you're going to get rid of the whiners and the people who just like to complain and not give you any solutions. But you're actually saying, if you don't know how to solve it, don't tell me about it. So, you know, and then you're cutting off people asking and being curious and wanting to help, but that maybe they're not qualified to help. So it's not that leaders had this bad intention. Everybody's trying to do their best. But we really sometimes inadvertently shut people down.
There's a standard out there, I think, that can be expected of others. It's almost like an intellectual perfection, right? Where some people can expect you to have all the answers, or you believe yourself that you're supposed to have all the answers. And curiosity is the antithesis to that. It's about knowing that you don't know everything and asking the questions.
Right. And that comes back to that vulnerability. A lot of leaders don't like to show they don't know everything, and they have to be that puffed up fish, you know, that tries to look different than they are. But, you know, I think we're seeing a lot less of that than we used to see. And I think that it can be challenging for people to let go of that need to look like they know everything. Mm. I've met some really great leaders. The guy who wrote the foreword for my book is Keith Kroc, who used to be the chairman and CEO of DocuSign and now is undersecretary in Washington. But he's one of the more impressive leaders I've ever met, because he just acts so humble. And this guy's super genius, you know, bright guy, but he doesn't act like that. He acts like, yeah, well, I surround myself with really great people who know really big things. And he knows, you know, everything that he should know, but he comes across as humble. And I think that that can be really important when you're surrounding yourself with people to listen to their ideas. And he obviously listened and created these billion-dollar companies with, you know, multiple billion-dollar companies. And he's a huge success because of it. And I think we need to model ourselves after that, because I you know, I've had people on my show talk about leaders fearing looking stupid, fearing people are going to know, figure out that they don't know as much as they should know. And there isn't a should know, you know, necessarily. I mean, it's just subjective and it changes. And I think that we have to understand that as leaders, we set the culture for the company. And if we're going to be faking it and pretending, then everybody else is going to be doing the same thing.
And once again, let's bring that back to our personal lives. If we expect that from our friends, if we, you know, ridicule our friends or our acquaintances when they don't know something, when they ask a question, we're going to create that same kind of unhealthy environment, right?
Well, yeah, the environment is such an interesting aspect of this, because we touched on fate, you know, in general, and the fear and the technology, but the environment part of the fate equation is, it's just everybody. You know, we talked about the school impact. We know family members sometimes, hey, you're expected to be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever in the family. You know, we've always owned the family business or whatever. So you get directed by people. You get influenced by your leaders. You get even influenced by social media. If you ever post something and people don't like it, then well, why you get taken down? Because, you know, it's not the thing. And, you know, there's so much pressure to think and act specific ways. And so I think that that's a real challenge. I mean, think of how much your siblings impact you. You know, well, that's a stupid thing to study, or that's a stupid thing to do. You know what I mean? Everybody's got pressures from every angle. And that leads to the fate part of A, which is our assumptions, that voice in your head. And okay, think of it like this. Okay, sometimes when I talk about assumptions and the voice in your head, I hold up a glass of water in front of the crowd and I say, how heavy is this water? And this is like the cake thing where you got to remember, this is coming back to curiosity. So they'll yell out, oh, I don't know, 8 ounces, 10 ounces or whatever they yell out. And I said, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's how long I hold it is how heavy it's going to be for me. If I hold it for a minute, it might not bother me. If I hold on to it for an hour, my arm starts to get tired. And if I hold on to it for a day, my arm feels paralyzed. So that's how our thoughts are. Our assumptions are like these thoughts that go over and over and over in our head. If we just fleeting thoughts, no big deal. After an hour, we obsess over it, you know, starts to be more problematic. And then the longer we hold on to it, we can become paralyzed by them. And so as we think about the things, oh, I would never be good at that, or that won't ever interest me, or I took that in the past and the teacher made it boring, or, you know, all the wealth of things we tell ourselves. It's recognizing that you're telling yourself these things that'll help you overcome them.
Well, self-awareness. So important in so many facets of our life.
Emotional intelligence again.
Yeah, right. So Diane, there are a gazillion things in the universe that we could learn about, that we could go and question and explore. Do you think it's possible to get curiosity fatigue or curiosity overwhelm?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a time where you have to be very specific and goal-oriented when you figure out, you know, the things you want to work on. You could get curious about Candy Crush and never get out of it. You know what I mean? We don't want that. We want productive curiosity that we know is going to lead somewhere. I mean, it's nice to have time to have your mind go mindless and some, you know, thing like that. But at work, we're talking about being very focused and having goals. And that's part of the Curiosity Code Index, is creating action plans that are measurable and very specific things that you could do to help you develop your level of curiosity. I mean, of course, you're not going to be able to know everything. Just, you know, there is information overload, and you have to be reasonable when you set goals and have them be in line with what's potentially possible in a day. But, you know, everybody has their different potentials. So what may seem overwhelming to me may not be overwhelming to you, or vice versa. And that's why I think these discussions are so important. When I train organizations, or I train HR professionals and consultants to train organizations, I do both. We have these sessions where we whiteboard all this stuff, you know, and people can connect with, you know, yeah, I feel that. And I understand that. And this is what I would, you know, find problematic. And as they start to do their personal action plan, they really get an idea that this isn't just me. Everybody else feels like this. And so I really, you know, get all these great ideas from the feedback in the room, and it's really productive. And then once they've gone through their personal action plan, then we go on and create a business plan for the leaders based on, okay, so now we know how to fix our own individual levels of curiosity, and we've got this action plan that we've created. We're going to create a plan for you guys from us to kind of help you. And I base this on some companies, like say Disney, for example, had a problem with turnover in their laundry division, for example. And you think everything's all great and glorious at Disney, but somebody has to iron linens and be down in the lovely part of the bowels of the organization, right? So there, it's not exactly the most glamorous job in the world, and they were having high turnover. And as fun as it sounds to iron sheets, they couldn't hold on to a lot of these people. And they started to think, well, what can we do to make this better? So they went to them and asked the employees, what can we do to make your job better? And they truly thought they're going to get things that they can't possibly fix, that maybe this is just, you know, part of the job kind of things. But really, they didn't. They got great ideas from the employees. They got things like put an air vent over my workstation, make my table go up and down so my back doesn't hurt so much, whatever things. And they were able to do those kinds of things. They go, yeah, we can fix that. And they really improved their turnover because they were able to do that. But they were able to do that because they asked these questions. And that's what we do in the second part of this training that I do, because we're asking all these questions. Okay, so leadership wants to fix emotional intelligence or critical thinking or innovation, or, you know, you go through the list of all the things that are the problems for the organization. You're going to the horse's mouth, just like Disney did. How can we help you be more curious to fix this problem? And then we whiteboard all those things, right? And then you get all these things as a big compilation, a huge report that we give back to leadership and go, here, this is like what Disney did. This is all your answers to all your problems. So basically, your employees are giving all the answers to the HR professionals or the consultant or whoever's training them, and giving it to leaders. And then leaders, it's up to them to decide, you know, what works and what doesn't.
So it's really about taking this sort of nebulous idea of curiosity, this incredible tool that we have in our brains, and narrowing that focus down. So it's like a lightsaber, right? And you're just cutting through to the information that you most need to create or innovate.
Right. And it seems like such a common thing that we talk about curiosity so often that, you know, what's so interesting when I started to write the book, because my radio show, I interview all these billionaires and geniuses, and I'm like, wow, these guys are super curious. This is great. And then I still teach at quite a few universities. I've taught more than 1,000 business courses, and I've had a lot of students, and I found like a lot of them really wanted you to give them the fish instead of teach them to fish. And I wanted to instill that curiosity in them. So as I started to interview people, I thought, well, I want to write a book about curiosity because it's just so interesting to me that people aren't curious. So as I started to write the book, I started to look for the assessments that you know, measured what kept people from being curious, and there wasn't anything out there. And there's just curiosity assessments that tell you how curious you are. So let's say I have low curiosity, then what do? And I'm like, well, that doesn't help me. It just tells me I don't have it. So I found that really fascinating. And I spent years researching people to find out what it is that held them back so that I could create my own assessment. I had gotten into assessments from studying emotional intelligence in my doctoral dissertation process. And I was very interested in how you can assess things. And I thought, well, of course you can assess this. You just got to figure out how to do it. So it took me a few years of research and thousands of people later. And then that's what led to the Curiosity Code Index so that we could actually get this information and we can find out what's holding us back.
So let's go back to you as a child, because you say that it was actually boredom that drove you to be curious and creative as a child, right?
Yeah.
In your experience, do you think that there are particular signs in our lives that kind of indicate that it's time for us to get more curious? It may be boredom. Do you feel that maybe dissatisfaction or discontent can be signs that it's time to engage our curiosity?
I think a lot of people have, you know, when you're a kid, you have different experiences. For me, I was 5 years younger than my next oldest sibling. I was the baby. So I was kind of alone a lot. And then my father was born blind and my mom took care of the home. And so she was busy doing that. And my father really, you know, was the one that had a big influence on my sense of curiosity, because everything was a game to him. At the dinner table, we played school. We did all these things all the time. So I was always taught to ask a lot of questions. Because we were encouraged to do all these like curious kinds of things, I guess I did get bored easily compared to other people. And I think some people don't get bored as easily, maybe. You know, I think there is personality involved in all of this. Anybody who's had more than one kid will tell you they're completely different right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to get everybody at the same level of curiosity. You're not going to all be, you know, Bill Gates and want to solve, you know, the Microsoft problem kind of thing. But we can all improve. We can all become more engaged. I really think engagement's one of the biggest factors that's tied to what I'm trying to do with this, with not just innovation. Those two are probably the top two.
In your work, you focus on business and career success, but some of my listeners might not necessarily be inspired by that kind of achievement. Can curiosity help us achieve goals in other ways, in other facets of our lives?
You know, everybody's got their different motivations for what makes them happy and what makes them, you know, driven. And for some people, it might be money. For some people, it might be something else. But that's why we have to ask these questions. Mm. You know, I'm really passionate about picture taking, or I'm really passionate about something that has nothing to do with money, of changing the world by saving children. You know, I've had the guy on my show that created Charity Water, and that made him completely passionate to do that. You know, you don't know what it is until you start asking these questions and start focusing on just, why am I sitting here watching the faucet drip all day when I could be out really living? I think a lot of people just exist. And that causes you to be disengaged. You just, you know, time to make the donuts was a commercial when I was a kid, a Dunkin' Donut commercial. A guy got up every day and said the same thing, time to make the donuts, time to, you know, and his life was just making the donuts and nothing else. There's a lot of people that do that every day. They just get up, they do the same thing, they go to bed. They're just kind of walking dead, and that's what's happening. So, I mean, you've got to find the things that fit your passions. And to do that, you have to ask questions.
You have to start with the why and the why not. I love that.
Yeah.
Diane, my final question is one that I ask every guest on the Eudaimonia podcast. Can you offer a simple morning reminder? So this might be a practice, a mantra, perhaps a little ritual, something that can help my listeners activate their curiosity on a daily basis.
Well, I think if you just keep the words FATE in your mind, mm-hmm. and just think, I mean, the acronym, I should say, FATE in your mind, of the words fear, assumptions, technology, environment. What one thing can you overcome fear-wise today? If you've hesitated doing something because it sounded a little scary, what's one baby step that you could do to overcome something to do with fear? And analyze, if you're doing any kind of meditation or self-reflection, what thoughts are coming in your head that are saying, I'm not going to like this. This is driving me crazy, or whatever it is. And then try to think of an alternative way to overcome that issue. And then technology, maybe have one day if I was a high-tech day yesterday, maybe a low-tech day today, and try to learn the basics behind it and find out ways to get a little bit more tech savvy or less, you know, reliant on every other day. And then in your environment, consider who influenced you recently, who's telling you something that might be holding you back, that maybe they don't have all the answers, because no one does.
Those tips just seem so profound and really powerful. Thank you so much. Diane, if people want to know more about you and your amazing new book, which is called Cracking the Curiosity Code, where can people find you?
Well, my website's just my name, drdianehamilton.com. If you go there, you can get to my show and my everything else, but you can also just go right to the curiosity information at curiositycode.com. But either one, you can get to the curiosity information from my main website. You can follow me on all the social media sites at Dr. Diane Hamilton. If they take the Curiosity Code Index, again, that's at curiositycode.com, they'll get a 26-page PDF, kind of similar to taking DISC or emotional intelligence tests, where it takes maybe 10 minutes, and they get their results, and it tells you, you know, how to create your action plan, and it's a really good start to improving curiosity.
Dan, that sounds amazing. What a great way for us all to sort of engage greater curiosity and start sort of asking questions of ourselves and of our lives. I love that so much. I'm just so delighted to have had you on the Eudaimonia podcast, a truly fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Well, it was really my honor, Kim. You just have a wonderful show, and I was really looking forward to our chat and great questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "I think at a child's birth, if a mother could ask a fairy godmother to endow it with the most useful gift, that gift should be curiosity." You've been listening to the Eudaimonia podcast. If you'd like to learn more about how to live a truly flourishing life, please subscribe and check out eudaimoniapod.com for more inspiring episodes. I'm Kim Forrester. Until next time, be well, be kind to yourself, and ignite your curiosity.